The Supreme Court issued a number of significant rulings this week. We're going to talk about two of them. One that turned aside a high-profile effort by New York City leaders to hold gun manufacturers responsible for selling weapons that end up being used in illegal activity. The second ruling affects enforcement of voting rights legislation. Joining us now to talk about what these rulings mean are Nancy Ramirez. She's Western Regional Counsel for the Mexican American Legal Defense Fund, also known as MALDEF. And Mary Che is a professor of constitutional law at George Washington University. She's also a member of Washington, D.C.'s City Council. Welcome to you both.
Good morning.
Good. Thank you for having me.
Councilwoman, I'm going to start with you and with the gun case. The Supreme Court refused to hear a case by New York City that tried to hold gun makers responsible when their weapons end up being used in crimes. It doesn't seem like a surprise that the court would rule this way. This case was first filed in 2000, then again in 2004. But in 2005, President Bush signed a bill immunizing gun makers from liability for these kinds of issues. So what was the basis for this case going forward?
Well, there was an exception in the law that said that you might be able to get outside of that immunity for the gun manufacturers if you could show that the manufacturers had violated a law that was aimed at preventing gun violence. And the idea that New York had was, well, gee, you know, we have a nuisance law, and guns are a nuisance. They cause injury, and that should qualify as an exception under the law. But the lower court held against New York, and the Supreme Court decided not to review that case, leaving the outcome standing. And in some sense, it wasn't a surprise because it was a bit of a reach, but there was a plausible argument that there was an exception.
And Mayor Bloomberg, which supported going forward in this case, said that he's going to pursue any other legal avenues available to him. Are there any?
Well, you know, it's kind of curious what's happening now. You have a situation where localities are trying to protect their citizens from gun violence and guns in general. And at the same time, you have another force, you know, the gun lobby, that's been very effective in Congress in getting laws to protect against lawsuits and things of that sort. So what the mayor of New York is doing, what many jurisdictions are doing, and I think the District of Columbia is attempting to do it too, is to look at all possibilities. Now, some of those possibilities might be gun registration. Some of those possibilities might be attempting to find a more direct law to come under this statutory exemption. But, you know, it's getting harder and harder. Every time you pursue a path, the gun lobby is fairly successful in getting themselves exempt from any liability or accountability.
And as an example of just how significant the gun lobby is, the fact that the D.C. voting rights is again before the Congress and it's being held up in an effort to remove gun control legislation from the bill, which is kind of anomalous to give people the right to choose their own elected leaders and then say only if you...
No, it's really quite shameful.
You know, only if you vote this way
exactly.
on a particular issue.
You can have a vote in Congress if you allow us to tell you how to protect your people. I think it's quite curious that senators, for example, from Nevada don't have enough to do with their own unemployment rate and their mortgage foreclosures that they have to involve themselves in local law of D.C. because the matter involves guns.
But it does show the significance of this particular issue in the society, even though it perhaps is only of interest to a particular group of people. Let's move on to the voting rights case. Mm-hmm. The Voting Rights Act was designed to outlaw not only egregious abuses that kept minorities from voting, but also to make sure their participation was meaningful. Nancy, the Supreme Court said a portion of the law aimed at helping minorities elect their preferred candidates only applies in districts where minorities make up more than half the population. So if you just give us some background here, how did this case arise?
Sure. This case is arising out of the state of North Carolina. And in North Carolina, they have a state law that requires that counties not be split when you are creating districts. And in that situation, there was a district that they decided to create that was 39% African American, but it split several counties. And they decided to maintain that district despite the county split because it allowed the minorities to elect the candidate of choice. It was challenged by the state because the state argued that it violated their own state laws requiring counties to be maintained whole. And after it was decided by the courts there, the North Carolina Supreme Court basically held that the minority group must comprise a majority of the district in order for it to be protected under the Voting Rights Act. and the U.S. Supreme Court took up that decision.
Nancy, the obvious question for many people will be that if this country is willing to elect an African-American man as president, why isn't it reasonable then to say that there needs to be a supermajority of African or minority voters, black or Latino, in order to occasion this kind of involvement in creating legislative districts? What do you say to that? Or what does MALDEF say to that?
Well, you have to look at every jurisdiction individually. You cannot wholesale say that now that we have a black president that we've eliminated racial discrimination, that we've eliminated racially polarized voting, which is basically where you have certain voters refusing to vote for minority candidates. And that still does exist, and you have to do very local analysis in order to make that determination.
Mary J., what's your take on this case?
Well, you know, just to give it some context, the Voting Rights Act of 1965 was an extraordinary statute that's been extended and amended over time. And Section 2, which is the section that's involved in this case, basically says that it's a violation of law to deny or abridge the right to vote on the basis of race or use practices that do that. And one of the practices that can do that is to dilute the strength of minority voting. So that, for example, let's say you have a majority of African Americans and you split them in two districts. That may make their ability to choose their preferred candidate diminished. You might dilute, in other words, their vote. And so Section 2 has been interpreted to require that where there is a geographically compact group of racial minority that is a majority, that you are bound with other circumstances, but you are bound under the law to create a district to allow them to choose their preferred candidate. The issue in this case is, well, what if it's not a majority? What if it's less than a majority? Do you have to actually enhance the ability of minority voters to have a sufficient number, and a big question was how much, a sufficient number so that they could, with some crossover votes, still get their preferred candidate? And the court, the majority said, it was a plurality with two others joining, basically said, no, the law doesn't go that far. You don't have to enhance the prospect that far because it's not, at least for those justices, required under the law.
And Mary, I want to ask the same question I asked Nancy, which is that don't the national election results and the recent election suggest that crossover voting is in fact occurring?
So, well, it is, and but the debate even among the justices was which interpretation is more likely to lead to racial polarization. The dissenter said that if you don't require this under the law, basically what you're doing is you're going to force jurisdictions to pack racial minorities into districts and thereby create these minority-majority districts and not have the flexibility to invite crossovers. But the majority of the court in rejecting that idea said racial polarization will increase because what this will mean is that every time you draw new districts, every census when you have to draw new districts, and this would apply nationwide, that you would have to take into account even and every jurisdiction where there was a sufficient number, and it's unclear what that would be, that would enhance the ability of minorities to elect their preferred candidate. And the court absolutely wanted to avoid getting into that thicket of deciding political predictions about how racial groups vote and predictions over time about how they vote.
Nancy, what's your take and MALDEF's take on this question? There are those who argue that this case has more of an immediate impact on Latino voters than on black voters because they tend to be a plurality in a lot of districts and not a supermajority. On the other hand, there are those who say, well, wait a minute, Latino voters are crossover voters. They've shown a willingness to vote for candidates of either party and to vote in coalition with either whites or blacks. So how is this necessary? What's your take on this question? We only have about a minute left.
Well, there's a couple of issues. In particular, if you're looking at states such as California that are very diverse, you're looking at a number of minority groups, and it's not just a black-white issue, as the court decided in the North Carolina case. In California, for example, you're dealing with Asian Americans, African Americans, and Latinos, and you need to weigh all of those various interests, and I don't think that this decision really addressed that issue. And in particular, the Latino community is impacted because we have the citizenship issue. One of the requirements is that you look at eligible voting population, which requires that you take into consideration citizenship. And the majority in the Bartlett decision didn't really address that issue.
Complicated question. We'll obviously have to return to it at some point. I'm afraid that we're out of time. Nancy Ramirez is Western Regional Counsel for the Mexican American Legal Defense Fund. She joined us from our bureau in Culver City, California. Mary Che is a D.C. councilwoman and a law professor at George Washington University. She joined us here in our Washington, D.C. studios. Thank you both so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.